Good morning. Welcome to Mountain Money. This is Larry Warren along with Doug Wells, and Sundance has left the building. We have our town back, Doug.
We do. Boy, I think that might be the most crowded I've seen a Sundance. I don't know what the numbers are, but it seemed like it was extremely well attended. Made to feel even more crowded because of that plethora of snow we got that week.
Indeed, that plethora made for some of the best skiing I've ever had in my life.
I did take a powder morning midweek last week.
My gosh, that was amazing. And we are headed to a high of 36 today. It's going to be in the high 30s and into the 40s midweek. We're not looking for any snow until perhaps Thursday night or Friday. So what you see is what you're going to get for the next several days. And what you're going to get on this show are conversations with two Park City residents who are in two different professions, law and engineering. And our first guest will be Christina Miller of Miller Law Group, and she's here to talk about what happens to your finances in the event of divorce or other crises in your life. So we're going to ponder some of the things you need to be thinking of if you're in that situation or if it looks like you're headed onto the rocks.
And our second guest is his profession is helping to avoid crises, and he is Tim Douglas. He is the owner of Wasatch Composite Analysis, and I mentioned he's in the business of avoiding crises because what he does is he tests products that are made out of composite and metallic structures and makes sure that they are structurally sound. So that'll be a good conversation. We don't have many people coming in as guests that have expertise in his area, specifically space aircraft and space vehicles.
And there's so much of that industry along the Wasatch Front.
There really is, and the state gets credit for developing that. That's one of the core technologies that they're working to develop here in Utah. You're listening to Mountain Money. It's going to be a good show. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of contemporary and mountain modern home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake and offer complete design services. We are on the web at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch counties.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. In studio with us is Christina Miller. She is the founder of Miller Law Group. She practices family law, which primarily probably involves a lot of divorces. Unfortunately, probably 50% of our audience, if statistics hold true in here in Park City as they do nationwide, 50% of our audience is at some point in their life going to experience a divorce. So we're glad to have Christina in here to give us some advice and thoughts about how to make that process as painless as possible. Christina, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a business show, so I want to focus primarily on the financial impact of divorce. And I think there's a misconception out there that people have that there's a lot of variation possible in the outcome, the financial outcome of a divorce. Talk to us about that.
Well, you know, there's Utah law isn't prolific in the sense that we have case after case after case on any specific topic, particularly in divorce. So there is some gray area for a judge to have some discretion on what to do with finances, but it is pretty well set that the presumption is every dollar you acquire during marriage, every asset, every debt is presumably marital, and for the most part, Utah courts say split 50-50. So there are some nuances to that, but your bandwidth of possibility is just not that broad on what may or may not happen in your divorce as it relates to your finances.
And you had mentioned, you were here a little bit early in the studio and we were talking ahead of time, you had mentioned, although we're a small town, we're probably a town that experiences a couple hundred divorces a year here. And so you have a lot of experience seeing people go through the process. What are some of the big mistakes that people make that maybe if they had better advice going into the divorce, they could avoid?
So some of the biggest mistakes, I think, are for people who try and hang on to all of their finances and aren't given the appropriate counsel that half of those finances are going to go elsewhere to your spouse or be divided in half. And they aren't terribly transparent. So you have somebody who may be the wage earner or the moneyed person in the divorce who was very fearful about what life is going to look like after the divorce. And so they tend to keep all of their documents and all of their information really close to the vest. From the other side of the coin, for an attorney and their client, that looks like they're hiding something. And so then you start digging deeper and the two parties start butting heads because then it looks like the non-moneyed party is trying to get more than their fair share. So I counsel clients all the time that the more transparent you can be up front, providing any documents that are necessary, answering whatever questions there are in case there are some questions as part of the investment portfolio or investment packet that need to be answered, the better off you're going to be in the long run, because the other side's going to trust you more.
So in a divorce, I imagine you see couples all the way from ones who want to stay friends and have an amicable parting of the ways to couples who are really at war with each other. But does it matter the attitude going in? The result is still going to be the same regardless?
Yes, regardless. Well, I should say the result may not quite be the same because the people who start off with the mentality of a war as opposed to peace, since you can't fight, you can't prepare for both peace and war at the same time. The people that are preparing for war will have a different outcome in the sense that they will spend substantially more on attorney's fees for essentially the same financial outcome at the end, except they'll have less money in their pocket because it will be in their attorney's pocket.
What would you say the average divorce, the legal cost of it, is for a couple?
Well, if you went to an attorney and had already sat down with your spouse and worked out some of the financial arrangements and it simply needed to be put down on paper, that average cost is $3,000 to $5,000. If you are in the median, so you're heading to mediation, you're using your attorney to review the documents with you, provide spreadsheets, attend mediation with you, and so forth, that cost is probably $20,000. If you are in all-out war, we've had divorces that have cost $250,000 per person, per side, with that just being the attorney's fees. That doesn't include expert witness fees for the forensic accountant and custody evaluators and tax professionals and so forth.
So Utah law says that everything acquired in a marriage has to be divided 50-50. So what happens if some spouse came into the marriage wealthy and the other came in less wealthy? And what if one of them has a big inheritance in the course of their marriage or will get one soon after the divorce?
Well, let me start by saying this. Utah law isn't as specific as saying everything's 50-50.
Okay.
It says the marital presumption is that it will be split, quote unquote, equitably. It's just that courts have interpreted that to mean 50-50. Courts can divide it 60-40 if circumstances present themselves for that. So if you have a 50-year marriage with a stay-at-home person and somebody who has reached $1 million in income per year, those assets may be divided differently if that incomed person was going to go on to work more and so forth. But presumably, almost everybody is split 50-50. So once you start with that presumption, then it's up to the person who's trying to prove a specific asset is not 50-50. It's up to them to prove it. So if you received an inheritance during the marriage, that's presumed to be divided between you and your spouse, and it's up to you to prove that A, the inheritance was given only to you and not to your spouse, B, that the inheritance was separated and kept separate throughout the marriage, so not commingled with a lot of marital funds. Sometimes you can trace that inheritance into a certain asset, and you can get that back or the inheritance back. So if you inherited $500,000 from your mother and it was given solely to you, and you put it into a house or a rental property, literally close in time to the time you got it, oftentimes you can get those funds back. But if you put that rental property in both of your names, some courts have said that might be a presumed gift to the other spouse during the marriage. And so in some of those nuances, you'll find there's argument to be had on what to do. But for the most part, if you don't have those type of issues in a case, it's just a matter of valuing assets. So valuing a business, valuing retirement, and dividing those up and figuring out how to divide them up.
So that's good advice that I think a lot of people maybe have heard a long time ago, but it's an important reminder about the inheritance in keeping those assets separate, particularly if you think you're at risk for a divorce. What about the subject of prenuptial? Probably most of the audience is already married. But for folks that aren't, you practice family law, which would involve things like prenuptials. And then a related question, is there such a thing as a postnuptial?
Yes and yes. So there are prenuptials, which are before the marriage, defining what assets are going to look like while you are married. Are you going to keep everything separate? Are you going to have some joint things? What if you give separate property to marital property? Is that a gift or a loan? What if you give marital property to separate property? Is that a gift or a loan? That's what a prenup defines. You can also do a postnup, which is just as valid in Utah, which is entered into after the marriage, but also to define some rights. And a lot of people do that when they are at a point in their relationship when their arguments over finances has exceeded their ability to stay together. So they deal with that in a postnup instead of a divorce to try and stave off or avoid a divorce altogether, define those rights. And then if you're just in a relationship and you start, especially if it's your second, if you've been divorced and you're entering into another relationship, you can have a cohabitation agreement or a relationship agreement that also defines those rights. Because a lot of people these days, especially for second and third relationships, just aren't getting married, but they still have the possibility that if they are looked upon as a married couple, one of them could potentially try to establish a common law marriage, and they would go through the exact same thing as if they were.
What is common law marriage? At what point does that get what is it, and at what point does it get triggered?
So common law marriage is when you're not actually married. You haven't had a ceremony to consummate the marital vows, but you have to meet some pretty specific criteria under Utah law. So you have to live as husband and wife. You have to hold yourselves out as being married. So you'll have to bring witnesses into court that say, oh, no, Joe told me that they were married, or we filled out an R.C. Willie credit application as Mr. and Mrs. Joe Smith. You have to have established a general reputation as a married couple. So it's not terribly easy to prove, but it is nonetheless extremely court specific, which means a lot of attorney's fees to prove it and or fight it if somebody's trying to prove common law.
Well, my misconception apparently is that it was strictly amount of time spent living together and that it was 7 years.
Nope.
Got that one wrong. Okay. Let's talk about, you know, it financially for most couples, I would imagine, the biggest asset is the house. So does it naturally fall to one person to get the house, or what's your best advice? Should you just sell it and start over?
Well, it kind of depends. So you have to look at all of the assets as a whole, and I typically tell clients, I'm really visual learner, so I teach clients kind of in a visual perspective about divorce. So I tell them it's like a football field. And so you have all of your assets on the sidelines, and you're trying to line up all of these assets to make them equal on each side of the 50-yard line. But you're not lining up numbers of players. You're lining up weight. So if somebody has $1 million or $2 million player on their side, a house, if there's $2 million in investment or something else, you can put that on the other side of the 50-yard line, and those two things somewhat equal out, saving off some discussion of about capital gains and taxes and so forth. But those two things, you can eventually have parity. If you don't have assets that are equal to the equity in your house, then you have to talk about, now what do you do with the house? Who gets it? And if somebody does get it, how do they pay the other person their one half of the equity? And oftentimes the person that says they want the house wants it for an emotional reason versus a financial or a justifiably financial reason. And so as an attorney, you have to talk with them through that and that emotional burden that comes with divorce so that they don't make a poor financial choice for a psychological reason.
Well, and you mentioned earlier about capital gains in other tax situations. You know, all assets are not equal. Just because some has a market value, some one thing may be taxed at a higher rate than another. One may be in a tax-deferred account. One may be liquid. One may be illiquid. How do you look at that when you're looking at the balance sheet and splitting things up?
So that's a good question. You have to keep that in mind. And sometimes people forget that. They just look at the printout from their retirement account and say, oh, it's $1 million. It equals the equity in the house. But that's not really the whole picture, because that retirement account dollars, those dollars will come out and have a tax consequence with income taxes. So you have to kind of guesstimate what their tax bracket will be when they start drawing out that retirement account, take it off the top to come up with the value of that, and then look at the house and look at whether there's capital gains, and take capital gains if necessary off the top. And then you look at it and say, if the capital gains are $400,000 in the house, it makes more sense for the parties to sell the house together sometimes, because they can each take a $250,000 capital gain exemption versus one party getting it and now they have to pay capital gains on anything over $250,000. So each of those nuances you have to not only know about in the tax code and everywhere else, but then talk to your client about, so when they're getting an asset like a house, they aren't surprised years down the road when they have a huge capital gain exposure.
And that, of course, requires cooperation from the soon-to-be divorcing spouses, which it can be a difficult time for them to do that. It also requires cooperation between the divorce attorneys. You had mentioned things that ratchet up the cost of a divorce. And sometimes there's a battle between the two divorce attorneys. How can people avoid that? How can they make sure they're choosing divorce attorneys that are good for them individually, but also work well together?
Well, I think everybody going through a divorce should interview more than one divorce attorney and choose one that fits with their personality and their style and their desires as it relates to the divorce proceeding. So I always tell clients there really are two different divorce attorneys. There's Scorch of the Earth, who you tell them what you want, and that's what they're going to go after regardless of the shrapnel hitting the kids or the shrapnel hitting your pocketbook. They're really singularly focused. And then there are more holistic divorce attorneys that are looking at the fact that you have kids and what you should be doing with your spouse and in cooperation with your spouse so that those children aren't injured or so that your pocketbook isn't injured. So you need to find one really that works with your style and that you feel good about, and not one that just says what you want to hear, and one that keeps you in check, because everybody going through a divorce is situationally crazy, so to speak. That's a layman's term. And so you need an attorney that will push them a little bit or question them a little bit or understand the psychology and the emotion of how those things are affecting their financial decisions and so forth.
Is there an alternative to having two adversarial attorneys? Can you hire a mediator? Generally, they're like retired judges who have mediation practices.
You absolutely can hire a mediator. In fact, I encourage all of my clients 100% have to attend mediation at some point in the game, whether they attend with me or without me. But everybody should seek counsel, should at least have one session with an attorney prior to their divorce so they understand their rights and understand what documents they need to gather up in order to really figure out their financial picture and understand where that picture may go. And so if I have clients that don't want an attorney present at mediation, when I meet with them, I will come up with their risk alternatives. So in each asset, the negative aspect of keeping it, the positive aspect of keeping it, and where their range should be in terms of settlement, worst case and best case scenario. And then we send them into mediation with a spreadsheet, and they can make all their own decisions there with a skilled mediator. But they understand what they're giving up, which I think is the important part, because often if there isn't an attorney or they didn't understand what they were doing when they went into the divorce process and the divorce settlement, years later, they're either very upset with themselves or their spouse, or they're back in court arguing over something else.
Yeah, these are big decisions that have major impacts. And one of the themes in my business, I'm in the financial advising business, is the goal is to make a lifetime of good decisions. And a divorce presents you a lot of very important decisions in a short period of time when you're probably at a state of mind where it's hard to make good decisions.
Right.
How do you help clients navigate that?
Well, I have an amazing paralegal who's been with me for 20 years plus, Leslie, and she is an enormous help to clients. I also think years of experience of doing it are helpful because you can tell clients the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I also turn all of them on to other experts that exceed my expertise. So I'll turn them towards a financial planner. I will turn them towards their accountant for a tax question. I will make sure that they've at least explored the possibility of seeing a mental health professional so that they can understand those nuances of psychology and emotion bleeding over into this divorce life and kind of work as a whole team to try and make sure that they are well protected, or at least that they're understanding how to protect themselves in this and going forward.
You said something in the green room before the interview. I was asking you how you choose your clients. As I mentioned, there's a couple hundred divorces a year in this town. There's a half a dozen, maybe a dozen at most, divorce attorneys in this town. And you mentioned that you have to like your client. And your client has to trust you and the importance of that. And I think that's really important. That there's that bond of trust between whoever your attorney is and the client, particularly because you used the term earlier, situationally crazy. And what unfortunately in my firm, we have one or two families go through a divorce from our client base each year. And one of the things I share with folks is give yourself permission and understand you're probably going to see the worst of your spouse during this process, and you're probably going to see the worst of yourself during this process too. It's really hard. There's a lot of emotions. I mean, you think about two of the biggest, hardest emotions to deal with are rejection, and there's probably one spouse that's going through rejection. Another emotion that's really hard to process is betrayal, and oftentimes there's betrayal that's involved in a divorce. Talk to us about the emotional side of divorce and how you help your clients through that.
So one of the key things you can do is just help them recognize it, that and appreciate it and understand it, so that they understand this isn't an unusual emotion that they're feeling. So betrayal is one of them. Failure is a huge emotion going through divorce, because you don't go into a marriage anticipating you're going to get divorced. And so a lot of those people not only are feeling rejection, but they're feeling failure in the sense that they're what they thought was going to be the rest of their life is not. They have fear for what this is going to look like for them financially, fear for what it's going to look for them emotionally, future dating, getting back out in that dating scene if they have children. There's a whole another set of emotions, including all of those, fear for your kids and what they're going to go through, fear of rejection for future partners, fear of losing money or not quite making it, or if you're close to retirement and you don't have a lot of retirement dollars and you are relying on either the inheritance to be your retirement for the whole marital package, fear that now you don't have retirement dollars and what that's going to look like. For a lot of non-moneyed spouses, fear of getting back into the working place and making friends and losing friends that you made during the marriage. It's riddled with emotion that colors financial decisions quite a bit.
Well, on that cheery note.
Yeah. Well, let me ask one last question.
Okay, we'll go out on a high note
so,
here.
Yeah, so these are a lot of challenges of being a divorce attorney. I was maybe a more optimistic note is, what do you like about being a divorce attorney? What keeps you excited about staying in your profession and coming to work every day?
You know, for the most part, I love our clients. And the thing I love about doing what I do is you can take this person that comes in who is in this complete state of crisis and help them navigate this dissolution of the finances and the kids and so forth. And if you're doing it from a holistic perspective, you can give them introspect into themselves, into their relationship, into their kids, and you can help them navigate the process in the manner that is least destructive for them and for their whole family.
That does sound rewarding, and that's probably a better note for us to wrap up
on. That optimistic note, thanks for coming in, Christina Miller of Miller Law Group in Park City, family practice attorney. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And
thanks.
When we come back, we'll be talking about composites, those carbon fiber and other kinds of structures that are in airplanes, spacecraft, with Tim Douglas, who helps design them. We'll be back after this.
This is Ryan Hoffman, manager at Mountain West Bank, sponsor of KPCW. We're a community bank with a great understanding of our local needs. Mountain West Bank has something unheard of nowadays, but I can't say it on the radio. We're next to the movies near Kearns Boulevard at 649-3369. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Cookies on Fridays.
Gordo here. And I'm Larry with All Resort Group, a proud sponsor of KPCW.
Since 1974, we've been part of this community with shared ride, private van, and SUV service for our customers.
Reservations available at allresort.com or 649-3999.
We move people.
This is Allison Kulo with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Joining the Chamber Bureau provides your business with benefits, from lodging projections, educational videos, group sales leads, and a listing on the top travel site for Park City, and much more. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining can be found at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization and KPCW supporter.
And welcome back to Mountain Money. We have Tim Douglas in studio with us now. Tim is a Park City-based engineer. He owns Wasatch Composite Analysis. And this is a consulting company, a testing company?
Yeah, I'd call it an engineering services company. We're consultants, and we do basically structural analysis and testing of composite structures primarily for aerospace industry, primarily aerospace.
And as Doug mentioned, there is a cluster of technology companies dealing with aerospace and dealing with composites, which are these substitutes for metal that end up being way stronger in many cases than metal, and they're used in planes because they're lighter weight and spacecraft because they're lighter weight.
So it's kind of interesting that this it's called a composite cluster, basically, and you know the state of Utah has actually been pretty involved in expanding that, and it all comes back from back in it's probably the late 70s when Hercules, which was a DuPont company down in Salt Lake City, they were making explosives for Kennecott, and they made a decision to move into rocket motors. And part of that was the development of composite materials, carbon, primarily carbon and Kevlar. But basically, in the early 70s, Hercules built the first composite production fiber line, and that was for the military, primarily for the Navy. And that it was the first production facility of carbon fiber. And that kind of grew into many different industries over the last 40 years. And it was the seed that produced this composite cluster.
And so in this cluster is everything from building parts for aircraft to building bicycle
parts. Envy Composites up in Ogden is a good example. There are also other commercial applications that people are getting into, and the automotive industry is really getting large in composites.
Well, you know, when people think of composites, they think high tech, right? Mm-hmm. It still has this connotation of new and cutting edge technology. And about 20 years ago, I was an engineer for a Fortune 500 company, and one of my company's clients made parts from composites for the military. I can't give too many details. There was a security clearance involved in it for me. And frankly, I was shocked when I finally got the clearance and went and saw how these composite parts were made. Again, this was 20, maybe 25 years ago, but they were all hand-laid. Mm-hmm. And I was expecting robots and lasers cutting things, and it's a bunch of people hand-laying fabric and cutting it by hand and putting glue on by hand.
Right.
How are composites made today?
So that was the old style. Now there are what they basically call them fiber placement machines, which they can, it's a robot that basically does all the hand layup itself. It applies the plies of carbon and epoxy. It's actually a mixed prepreg. And the prepreg is then laid up using robots on molds and various things. ATK up in Clearfield has probably the largest fiber placement machine in the world, and they build the stringers and frames for the Airbus A320.
The new one.
It's all composite. And these machines are laying up parts that are 50, 60 feet long and all in one piece, and then they then have to cure them. But so nowadays there is still hand layup, and for low scale one-off parts, that's the way you'll do it.
But in production, it looks high tech now.
Yeah,
so
the
time
is.
Has finally come, because I was worried for the country. It's like, really, this is our super duper secret,
right?
Is a bunch of people laying up composite parts. So composites also are not a fix-it for everything. Composites have their weaknesses as well. Talk
yes.
to us about what are some of the weaknesses with composites.
So, you know, the composite world revolves around, usually it's saving weight. And so applications where, you know, you're going to fly this thing, you're going to put it in an aircraft, you're going to put it up in space. Those are the places where you can get into that. But there are some issues with impact. There are some problems if, for example, the application is something that is going to be repetitively hit with something, or it's got to protect. That's an application that doesn't work very well, because the epoxy itself, if it's an epoxy resin, is somewhat brittle, and it can cause some problems. The other problem is an interface between different materials, a metallic to a carbon material. If there are some thermal environments that it has to live with, say it's going to be really cold, the expansion difference in thermal expansion between the metallic and the carbon are significantly different. And that can cause some problems, where you can do some temperature cycling and the carbon will actually disbond from the metallic structure. So you've got to be really careful about the application.
And people will be shocked how you solve that type of issue. There's also corrosion issues.
Yep.
And the solutions to that are often just shims between the spaces. And, you know, these shims were put in place 20, 30, 40 years ago, and these aircraft have a life of, you know, a long period
right.
of time. I always looked at that and I said, really? You know, that's how this is done?
I presume these aren't the shims you buy at Home Depot.
It is remarkably similar. Yeah, it's
oh, really?
Remarkably similar.
Ouch.
So what do you know, as an outsider that's not a composite expert, I kind of looked at that as kind of a makeshift solution.
Uh-huh.
What's your sense of that?
Well, here's an example of where you talk about corrosion. Corrosion, there is definitely a difference in the corrosive ability.
Dissimilar material corrosion. Right?
So galvanic corrosion is what's called. So you can put in a barrier, which is what you're talking about, a shim. So an example of a aluminum to composite can be a problem. So what they'll do is they'll actually put in a little thin film of adhesive instead of shimming nowadays. But yeah, there are some things you got to worry about and you got to take care of and make sure you've got
it. And that's why we need experts like yourself. Now, what is your area of expertise? What kind of testing are you doing on these parts?
So primarily, Wasatch Composite Analysis, we are structural engineers, mostly structural engineers. And so we do primarily design of structures and then also develop the structure, build it, and test it. So we're not manufacturers. However, we do help smaller companies figure out how to build the structures, because one of the key things about carbon and or composite is you need to understand how it's manufactured too, because that does make a difference on the design of it. So we spend most of our time really staring at a computer screen, looking, you know, doing structural analysis. We use various software. Primarily our workhorse is it's called finite element analysis, which is it's a mathematical approach to modeling a structure and figuring out how it responds to whatever physical environment you're, if it's an acceleration or a load or a pressure or thermal load. We then model that in the computer and then optimize the design such that it meets the requirements.
So being unschooled in this as well, I would think that if you're doing composite analysis, you have pieces of wings and you're, I don't know, propelling bird or simulated
bird
birds,
yeah, we do bird
strike into
analysis.
Them and all that, but do you need to physically do that, or can you analyze everything through software?
Yes and no. If you're doing something for the first time, you got to have some physical test data. So, for example, one of the structures we worked on over the last couple of years was a deflector. You could call it that. It's called it was called a bird striker, and it sits on the aircraft fuselage just forward of a radome that's being protected by this structure. And so the first analysis we do, we've got some idea of its material strengths and properties. However, you do have to validate those inputs that you're putting into the computer, and the only way to do that is through physical testing. So they did run a bird strike, and where they basically propelled a big bean bag that hit the structure, and then from that we're able to monitor the strength and make predictions as far as how much of the structure failed.
So it reminds me of an old story I heard that they were hurling chickens into jet engines and that they were destroying the jet engines, and it's because the chickens were frozen chickens and it was like throwing rocks.
I think that might be folklore. I've heard that one as well. There's also
it makes a good story though, doesn't it?
There's also, as a fellow radio fan, WKRP in Cincinnati, where they gave away the turkeys on Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
I did, and they dropped them from a helicopter. I didn't know turkeys couldn't fly.
The exact quote, which lives on in infamy, is, "As God is my witness, I thought turkeys could fly."
Was that Les Nestor or whoever?
Les Nestor.
All right, Tim, let's get back to you.
Anyway,
I'm sorry. I've enjoyed that show for 20 years. Yes, we did. So you work in an unusual industry, you know, the federal government. There was a time where sovereign countries were the largest customers for the space industry. You really needed the intelligence and the bank accounts of a sovereign nation in order to be able to put spacecraft into orbit, into space. That's no longer the case.
Right.
The private sector,
really
driven SpaceX and Blue Ocean with Jeff Bezos' group. Is most of your business now in the private sector, or is the U.S. government your biggest customer?
It's It's a mix. It's a mix. But I would say 50-50. There are a lot of smaller companies, commercial companies, that are getting into composite structures for various reasons, primarily strength and weight. But it's actually pretty interesting because we've been working with another company that's just starting up, and we're doing some trajectory analysis, actually, where we're flying structures up into space for these guys. And this is a small startup company like SpaceX, but probably on a smaller scale, called B-Space out of Seattle. And so it's a privately funded company that needs these types of structures because they're doing the same thing that, you know, NASA and the military have been, you know, doing for years. So, you know, it's interesting that we're also involved in other commercial companies that are getting into different structures. We helped a company here in Park City called Star Seismic, and that since has been bought by another company, but we helped them do some structural analysis and design work of their sway braces. These are structures that go into buildings for earthquake protection. And
they make those out of composites. I'm shocked because weight's not that important. Oh, you were just doing the structural analysis,
right? Yeah, they don't. They're primarily steel and concrete.
Yeah. One of the big advantages you mentioned was weight, which is why I was surprised this would be composite and it's not. Give our audience a feel for what does it cost to put a pound of mass into orbit?
It's about $10,000 a pound.
Which is why these composite parts are so valuable.
Yeah, it's very expensive. And, you know, the other side of that is manned exploration. That gets really expensive. But, you know, and that's why you want to go with lighter materials, is because it takes so much energy to get that up.
And I'm curious, give us a little bit of history about your area of expertise, the composite parts. You know, when you look at a honeycomb part, it's called honeycomb for a reason. And it's really bizarre to think that bees came up with this structure in nature first. I assume that's how human beings got the idea for honeycomb. Is that right? Did we borrow that from bees?
It's structurally a very stable structure, you know, the hexagon shape. And it's very lightweight for the amount of structure you get from it. And so you're right, a honeycomb sandwich or panel is basically what you're doing is you're taking two sheets of carbon or composite material and putting it on top of, you know, a honeycomb, like a beehive, basically. Typically, the material is either aluminum or Nomex, which is a polymer, and sometimes they put fiber into that. So you get basically a separation of these two sheets, and what you're doing is increasing the aerial inertia of that structure. So the sandwich itself, that spacing, the strength really comes from the two sheets that are on top and bottom of the honeycomb core, and that spacing gives you the additional strength and resistance to roll and turn, and that's the aerial inertia. So by putting something that is really, is basically air, the honeycomb itself is a whole series of...
Which is why it weighs less.
Yeah, and all you're doing is you put it into a compression mode, which it is really good. A honeycomb core is really good at resisting compression. And so the compression between those two sheets of composite material results in a super lightweight but really strong material.
In one direction. Strong in one direction.
Well, in plane direction. So two directions.
So the other thing I want to share with our audience is if folks have never made a composite part, particularly if you have kids, you know, teenage kids that are somewhat interested in technology, it's not that complicated to make a composite part. And Larry, you can make these intricate shapes with it that would be hard to do any other way. So if you need, you know, a special box for a certain application, look up on YouTube how to make composite parts. The materials are not that expensive. It's not that complicated to do it, but be very careful. You usually need to be wearing a respirator when you do these things. You do want to make sure you have the correct protective equipment. But I do want to encourage folks, jump on YouTube, check it out. There's kits available. It's really neat to make. If you've never made one, it's neat to make at least one part.
Yeah, it is.
And I think just lastly, and maybe I'm putting you on the spot here, but can you think of a couple of products that are in use today that we probably encounter and don't have any idea that they're made out of a composite material? And then I guess a follow-up to that would be, what are some of the applications that are not presently in use but likely will be? I think one of them you hinted at, cars.
Yeah. I mean, BMW and their i3, that's a electric car that has, it's basically, its body is a molded composite. It's a unicoque form. It's basically all of the, what you would consider in most cases, aluminum. This is all carbon. So that's one area that is really moving ahead, because they've figured out ways to build these things quicker. You know, you're talking about hand layup, and it is very time consuming. But now they're coming up with injected carbon fiber polymers that they mold parts, right, you know, basically one part every 30 seconds. On small scale things, you can do that. But when you get to the size of like the i3 BMW car, it takes some time. And those are the places where if they can get the manufacturing time down and they can produce a bunch of parts quickly, that's where you'll see it appearing all over the place. And the automotive industry is one area that they're really working on that. Because when you look at the aircraft parts, they take hours and hours and days to build when it really comes down to it. So,
and they have to oftentimes have to be baked in these huge ovens because the part has to fit in the oven.
So they cure them or cook them or bake them in usually an autoclave, which is a pressure vessel. And, you know, I was talking about ATK up in Clearfield, they have five autoclaves that are 90 feet by, I think, like 25 foot diameters, 90 feet deep. So they're huge structures to cook these big things. And that takes a lot of time.
And then what are some common products that we may encounter daily?
Golf clubs. People know golf clubs now. The shafts are usually a pultrusion process to make those. You know, bicycle rims, frames, those are all now going to carbon. I was actually down in St. George riding my mountain bike and ran across a guy who was on a fully carbon electric mountain bike. So there, and the reason why you want that is it's a lightweight, very strong, and so.
Which brings us to a whole nother subject. The battery is the Achilles heel for all things electric, but that is a subject for another time. Our guest this morning has been Tim Douglas. He is the owner of Wasatch Composite Analysis. Tim, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
And we'll be back to wrap up Mountain Money after this.
Hi, I'm Davey Ratchard from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all Park City Mountain events can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weininger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to the final few minutes of Mountain Money. I want to thank our great guests, Christina Miller with Miller Law Group and Tim Douglas of Wasatch Composite Analysis. And Doug, we are now 2 weeks away from the Better Together KPCW pledge drive twice a year.
And we're going to be grateful for everybody for sponsoring and helping out on that. Larry, before we go there, I also want to thank the great sponsors of today's show. And that includes Mountain West Bank, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Jones, Waldo, Holbrook & McDonough, All Resort Group, Park City Mountain, and Apex Residences and Viridian Park City, Columbia Pacific Properties. Okay, now let's talk about, what is it, 2 weeks from now?
2 weeks from today. Start the pledge drive? At this hour, we will be into our third hour of the KPCW pledge drive. We only come twice a year. Last year, we did an experiment to see if we could raise the same amount of money in one less day. So we were able to that time in August, and we're going to try it again. We're going to have a pledge-free Friday as long as listeners step up and provide the funding we need to keep bringing local programming to you. So we hope you will be paying attention to us 2 weeks from now. Give us a call, donate online, or bid in our online auction.
And Larry, I think it's important to remind the audience, what percent of the station's budget comes from listeners?
One quarter.
It's an important
Not a
part.
Quarter of a percent. A quarter of our budget is from listener donations. So it's really essential. It's especially essential because with the new administration and the one-party dominance in Congress now, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting has already been targeted as one of the priorities for zeroing out that budget. And we've been trying to reduce our use of Corporation for Public Broadcasting funding, but it's still $150,000, and that would be a big hole for us to dig out of. So we would like to be girding
for
the future now.
It's important for the station to stay healthy. I think we're part of the fabric here in Park City. And part of a healthy public radio station is having community support. A fourth of the budget sounds about right, and it's important we all do our part. It's coming up in 2 weeks, and we hope you'll support us.
Yeah, and coming up next week on Mountain Money, I wanted to forward promote the fact that we'll have Rick Ridgway on our program. He is vice president of Patagonia, works with Yvonne Chouinard. They've been very critical of Utah political leadership and would like to see Utah go a different way in terms of its attitude toward public lands. And if you're in the climbing world, you know Rick Ridgway has climbed everything, has done a gazillion documentaries and books, and is a legend as a mountain climber. But he's also an executive with the Patagonia Corporation. And, of course, they just opened a flagship store here in Park City.
It's going to be great to have him on as a guest. And we are a business show, Larry. We should probably not let today wrap up without mentioning the market hit a milestone last week. The Dow crossed 20,000. It's since given some of that back. It's a tad below 20,000 as we speak right now. But it's good to see that. We're in the beginning of earnings reporting season, and the earnings are coming in strong.
And we only have 1 minute to go, so we can't do a deep analysis of the Trump administration. But I know a lot of tech companies are angry and nervous about the ban of immigration from the countries that he is banning travel from. And that is freaking out some of the tech companies because that's where they get a lot of engineers.
The general public. There were a lot of protests at airports throughout the nation this weekend.
So we will see what happens with the Trump administration and the economy in the coming months and, I guess, coming 4 years. Well, we're headed to a high of 36 under sunny skies today. Looks just gorgeous out there. Don't really have a chance of snow coming in again until about Thursday night, and then it's just a chance of snow. So enjoy this great week. It's a traffic-free week now. Thanks for joining us. This is KPCW